Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communications. I am your host, Marcy Maserato, and with me today, I have Elisaveta Friesen, author of the book Media is Us. Elisaveta, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So to start, can you share a little bit with our listeners about your background, professional background, educational background?
Oh, sure. So I am actually an immigrant from Russia. I have lived here about 10 years now. And I have two doctorate degrees. One is from Russia and one is from the United States, from Philadelphia. My second one is in media and communication. And my first one was very broad, social sciences, humanities. So I am, I would say, a generalist with a focus on human communication. But I also like to ask questions about human nature and all this good stuff that I'm sure we'll focus on now in our discussion.
Yeah, so you wrote this book, Media is Us, Understanding Communication and Moving Beyond Blame. And to kind of start our discussion, can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book with the very personal way that you approach the book as well?
So as I said, my second degree is in media and communication. So I have read lots of articles and books about media. And I realized at some point that a couple of things. First thing I realized that I don't see a lot of definitions of media. People just started talking about media texts, media representations, analyzing them. And there seemed to be like a underlying assumption that everybody knows what media is. And when I started teaching about media and I was asking my students what it is, I saw that actually this is an illusion that we have this shared understanding, because they would start giving me those huge lists, right? It was like books and internet and names of films or video games. And I would keep asking them, so what is it? And they're like, all this stuff. And so I felt that something was missing. So that's one thing. And the other thing was that I was not satisfied with the, I value all the great ideas that I got from all the books and articles about media representations and problems with media. But I felt that the angle, I wasn't satisfied with the angle that seemed like a lot of blame and fear. And so I sort of I was combining and recombining it in my head, trying to understand what is my sort of intuition telling me. And then I felt that the piece was missing, the recognition that, yes, there is technology and it's important to talk about technology, but the recognition that it's people who are doing media, right? And it's not just some other people, but it's each one of us. And so that's how I started writing this book, essentially.
Yeah, and that's, I really appreciate your approach. You know, as a media studies academic, I love that the concept of vulnerability, when you kind of contextualize this, where you're, because you're really speaking it from a very personal perspective, you know, as a scholar, but also just as a human engaging in communication in a very media saturated environment. So I definitely appreciate and can kind of identify with the vulnerability aspect of it. Mm. So can you talk about what that process was like for you to write this book that is not really what we would think of as an academic quote book on media studies?
That's a great question. Well, it took me about 5 years to write this book. And I actually rewrote it a few times in the process. And in the beginning, it was the voice that I used was very much my academic voice, the one that I used in my articles, in my dissertation. But I felt that I was not satisfied with that. I wanted it to be accessible to a broader audience. And that is how I started using a more personal voice and incorporating more examples that I thought would be relatable and compelling. So yeah, I guess that's in a nutshell what my process was.
Yeah, I think, and I super appreciate that. And you start, your introduction is actually, it spoke to me immediately because I had a student do a project on this Dove body wash ad.
Oh, really?
Wow. So this is great. Can you talk about that journey? Like, cause it seems like this was like a, you know, a aha moment for you, like from a personal and an academic standpoint as to like, oh wow, maybe this is really how I should approach this. Cause I think that we do, and we should as academics have those very human moments to be like, wow, I really did not handle that as I should have, but we're all human and we make those mistakes. So I'd love to hear you kind of contextualize that a little bit more.
Yes. Do you want me just to say a few words about this situation?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Just to kind of contextualize. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Just a brief clarification that this happened to me when I was already working on this book for like a year and a half, but I think it did help me bring more of that vulnerability to the table. And what happened was that I think it was 2017, I saw on social media a friend posting about a Dove body wash ad, and my friend was very upset about the ad because the ad seemed racist, and I saw a snapshot from that ad, and it did look strange and suspicious because there was a black woman removing her shirt, and then underneath there was a redhead white woman. And so I did some more research online and saw that a lot of people were talking about that. Big media outlets were talking about that, putting this those two images together and saying, well, hey, what they're trying to say here, that if a black woman uses your product, they will be like clean and become white, because this is a horrible racist thing to say. And I did do some research, right? So I didn't just react after reading my friend's post on Facebook. But I didn't, as it turned out, later, I didn't do enough research because I was very emotional about that right away. And I posted my own a few lines on Facebook saying that it's horrible. And I opened it to everybody, for everybody to see, you know, public post. And in a very short period of time, I got a three comments from strangers. And the first two were short, so I was ready to dismiss them. But the third one was longer. And it said like, hey, did you really like see the whole thing? Because then after the redhead also removes her shirt. And under that shirt, there is another woman who has slightly darker hair, slightly darker skin and black hair, and looks kind of Hispanic, actually. So I was actually terrified when I read this, because I I was like, oh my God, I messed up. And I started doing more research now, having this new angle in mind. And I did find out that so what happened is that Dove was preparing and to go into launch a new campaign, and they took a snippet of this campaign that was those three women, but the campaign actually was supposed to have even more women of different shades of skin and hair in different racial, you know, ethnicities. So it just became so much more complicated all of a sudden once I made this additional step. And I started with the story because I feel like, you know, when people, you know, me included, you know, when we go online, for example, and read what some other people are saying, and we often experience strong emotions, and those emotions and prevent us from trying to understand this situation in a broader context. And then I just thought it's a good place to start to show how it's not just some other people. It's, you know, really each one of us has this, but not everybody maybe recognizes that.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's a great, and thank you for sharing that in detail, because I think that's a great example because, of the complexities and the nuances of our relationship with media from multiple different levels, whether it's professional or personal, because we often have, we see things out of context. And I think this is where, you know, the left will get in trouble with things politically, because if it's being taken out of context and it's like, oh, it's racist or it's this or it's that, but then we have to contextualize and say, well, wait a minute, this is actually an ad that was taken out of context.
Yeah.
And is it really, and is it not? So then obviously when you're talking about things about inclusivity and diversity and racism and, you know, and these kinds of things, it becomes so polarized and so difficult to make yourself vulnerable in that space, even to say, well, actually, no, this was a, you know, perhaps the ad wasn't the best to begin with, but looking at the intent, looking at the impact. So I just think that, you know, that was a great starting point. I was like immediately hooked when I was reading it, because one, I knew exactly what ad you're talking about. And most, when you do kind of a preliminary research, you really online, you really only see this transformation, you know, from one, from a Black female to a white female, which is just horrifying. Mm-hmm. On the surface, right? But then it's also so easy to like recontextualize things and create them into another object. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was, that's a kind of a great example. And then when you get into your first chapter, you start talking about what is media. Yeah. So how do you define media?
I guess the simplest way that I use throughout the book to define media is media is people communicating with each other through technology. Technology is a part of that, but it's a lot about people and how they use technology, and technology is also created by people, right? So it's not just some other people; it's really all of us. And in this sense, I want to broaden our perception of media from something that appeared just like a couple hundred years ago, maybe, to something that existed with us all along because of the way human beings communicate. And you know, we think about technology as something fairly recent, but you know what. Technology that was used to carve hieroglyphs on pyramids was also technically media, right? And even beyond that, we can say that language is a form of media because it's a tool that we learn that is not transparent, that reflects our biases, right? And that represents only allows us or forces us, depending on how you want to phrase it, to represent all of a fraction, like a frame of reality, our perception of reality. I feel like when we broaden our understanding of media this way, we can have a much more nuanced conversation about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, looking at communication, looking at media and communication, they often go hand in hand, but perhaps we like to kind of isolate them when we're looking at media. As you mentioned, you know, talking to students or like defining the concept of media as it's not, well, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. Right. So is it a text? Is it an apparatus? Is it the mass media machine, like the institution? So like, I think it's really a complexity of all of those and how we interact with those, which is why I really appreciate that when you talk about power. So you talk about, for example, the foundations of communication, you lay out several principles, which I think are helpful in terms of contextualizing communication and the importance of communication. And you really start by talking about how people need to communicate,
mm-hmm.
right? Then principle two, by communicating, people create the world around and within them. So kind of, you know, the meaning making and communication happens according to the rules of human perception and cognition. Communication reflects and reinforces power relationships that exist in society, which I think for me is, it relates very specifically to my academic research. And then you talk about people influence each other through communication. Is there any of these principles that how do you think that they fit in with each other? Do you think that there's one that's more important or more obvious than another, or how do you contextualize these principles within that greater conversation of media?
Well, thank you so much for reading out the principles, because I do think it's I hope that this is going to be one of the big takeaways for my readers. It's difficult to prioritize. I think that each one of them is, on the surface level, might seem almost like obvious, but my goal is to have people think deeper about what exactly that means. For example, people like the number five, people influence each other, right? Everybody who studied sociology knows the concept of socialization, right? So we live in society, we grow up surrounded by other people, and they influence how we are, how we see the world. And then in response, we're also influencing other people. And I think this is an aspect that is sometimes sort of gets lost when people start arguing about social issues and saying that, well, it's just like some other people who are doing stuff and deciding stuff. But I think for the focus for me is that we all influence each other, and by just our everyday actions that seem perfectly obvious and normal, like choosing where to live or what clothes to wear or how to decorate our house, we are communicating certain things to others. So communication for me is not just verbal communication, right? It's obviously communication has so many aspects. So just living your life a certain way is already communicating something to the world. And, you know, if a bunch of people decides to live their life a similar way, then they're communicating to others that this is their way and they think it's the right way, and et cetera, et cetera. So in this sense, my book is not trying to say that, well, somebody is worried about media's influence, but you shouldn't. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there are a lot of problematic things going on, but it's important to see it not as like somebody else is doing things to me, or somebody like bad is doing bad things to good people, right? But more like we all are in this process. We are all influencing each other by virtue of being human. So of course media influences people, because media is people and people influence each other. So this is what I was trying to say here. So I don't know if you want me to explain any other of the principles, but again, it's not, I chose that one not because I feel it's the most important one, but just I wanted to unpack it as an example.
Yeah, no, please, please unpack the other principles as well and in their relationship to each other and your ultimate argument about how media is us, right? That we're kind of intrinsically in this space together.
Okay. All right. So the first one is people need to communicate, which basically means that, I mean, it's connected to the fifth principle if we're talking about connections, because we grow up in society, we cannot be human. We cannot grow up human without communicating with other people, right? We can think about examples of children who were raised by animals. They're very rare, right? But that happened. And after a certain period of time, the children being with animals, they cannot be like fully members of society. And, you know, I don't know if you can say like they're fully human in a way, right? So we only can be human if we are surrounded by other people and communicating with them all the time. Again, meaning not just through words, but through body language. And I don't know if my listeners are aware that up to 90% of our communication happens through nonverbal communication, right? So, and there's visual communication as well. So we need to communicate to be human. In society, within society, people need to communicate in order for society to exist, for people to set and achieve common goals. You know, civilizations as we know them are possible through communication, because we can share knowledge, we can record and transmit knowledge to following generations, etc., etc. So, but the fact that we need to communicate doesn't mean that we know how to communicate in a way that won't hurt ourselves and others. And the comparison can be a food, right? We need to eat. Right. But it doesn't mean that we know how to eat healthy. Right. In fact, like we want to eat fatty foods and we want to eat sweet foods because this is a survival mechanism embedded in our genes, like telling us this is good. but actually it's not that good if we don't understand how it works. And the same thing with communication. The fact that we need to communicate doesn't mean that, you know, if we are. That we cannot be, say, addicted to certain forms of communication to the point where we don't understand how they are harming us, or that we don't know how to, or the fact that we need to communicate doesn't mean that we will not know how not to abuse our power when we're communicating with others. I'm kind of jumping between all those principles because really You can look at them in whatever order, and there is no hierarchy here, right? So I mentioned power, so I may as well talk about the fourth principle, which is about communication creating and reinforcing power relationships in society, and there I talk about the fact that whenever people interact, there is some kind of power relationship within this. A relationship within this interaction. Communication is a big part of that. So because through communication, say we can tell another person what to do, or we can signal to them what they are supposed to do, or what we think we are supposed to do. And obviously power in connected to communication is a huge topic. Analysis of media texts, for example, or presentations from a point of view of, like, who is benefiting from them, and who can hurt whom, or who is allowed to speak, who is invisible, and whose voices are prioritized. I think this is all super important. At the same time, I think it's important. It's also important to put it in this bigger context. Again, connecting it to the fifth principle, that because we influence each other, it's not as simple as there are kind of good, bad guys and good guys, or only sort of the most visible or seemingly powerful actors in society are the ones who are influencing influencing each other. I think it's more complicated because in some subtle ways we all influence each other in ways that are not necessarily obvious, right? And this is connected to the way we represent the world to each other. So this is the second principle, that we create the world by communicating. We create the world within ourselves and outside of ourselves, right? So by communicating, we learn who we are, about our identity, right? We see ourselves through others' eyes, other people's eyes, right? So in this sense, it's essential. This relationship with other people is essential for us to understand who we are. But at the same time, it's a lot about our interpretation and the spin we put on that. So we create the world for ourselves and for others. And this is a big topic in media studies, media literacy education, about representation and the fact that media does not represent reality the way it is, which is a, you know, very complex statement that is like we can unpack really for a long time, like what is reality, right? And what does it mean to represent reality? But the bottom line is that it's important to acknowledge that we all are representing our version, our understanding of the world to ourselves and to others, sort of. So it's essential to understand that when we turn on a news channel, for example, right, that there's somebody behind the story that we are watching who made decisions about, first of all, what to tell and then how to tell it, whom to interview and how long the story will be and what pictures, what videos to attach to the story, etc., etc., right? So it's essential. But it's also important to understand that it's not just the some other guys that behind, you know, the screen. It's us, because when we say go in to our friends and tell them how we saw the story, or even when we tell them about something that happened to us, right, we're also representing our version of reality to them. So I know it's a complicated sort of relationship, and it's tempting to say that, well, like news channels are by definition more powerful than people who watch them because they reach more people. But it's more complicated than that, because then everybody also interprets it from their own perspective, right? We know that people interpret other people or media from using their backgrounds and their notions and assumptions. So it's important to understand how complicated it is, and then take responsibility for the way we construct the world for ourselves and others, right? And connected to that, that's the third principle about people communicating in a way that represents their, or, and I'm looking for a different word, like their cognitive, certain cognitive principles or principles of their perception that are revealed through communication, and that shape communication, because we communicate according to the way our brains work, right? Well, like biases, cognitive biases that have become a big topic recently, like, you know, confirmation bias, everybody knows about that, right? So we filter information in a way that fits what we already believe in or what we already know. It doesn't mean that we never change our opinions, but often, more often than not, we look for things that confirm what we believe in, right? Which then, yeah, shapes a lot how we interpret things for ourselves and then for others, and influencing them, again, according to the fifth principle. So I guess those are, I tried sort of to show the connections between those principles. I do differently in the book, I don't know. Do you have any questions based on my explanations?
Yeah, I think...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think they're great principles. I think they do, as I mentioned earlier, like really show the nuance in relation to what our relationship is with media and what medium is in meaning makings and things like that, because it is complex. It is multifaceted. It's not just the evil media, as you mentioned that, for example, when you move into chapter two, we talk about imperfect meaning makers, and you state we don't have to be afraid of the evil media that can ruin our lives. We are what brings it into existence, so we should be able to control it. So, of course, like just taking that, it makes it sound like we're automatically just taking the power out of media institutions, which is not at all what you're doing.
Yeah.
We do talk about that in the next chapter. So can you expand on what you do mean by imperfect meaning makers? And I think you briefly mentioned that in relationship to the principle, but what does that really mean? What does that mean for us as we create and consume media and communicate and create meaning in that?
So thank you for bringing it up, because yeah, that's a big piece of my argument is, first of all, that human beings as meaning makers, right? So we might feel that, I think it's not uncommon to think that things by definition, like they mean something, or they like things are like, there's some kind of truth out there that we are looking for. This is the perfect, ideal, objective truth that we're looking for. And then we are experiencing our world, and we think, oh, you know, are we getting closer to that truth? Like, this is our, I guess, approach in our heads, right? But we're forgetting that it's not just about looking for some objective truth. It's about creating interpretations of the world around us. So it's not just looking for some meanings that are out there waiting to be discovered. It's actually creating meanings in the process. And I love the framework of symbolic interactionism that I use in my book, and also the social construction of reality. And to clarify, I don't think that everything is socially constructed, but I think that human beings like do a lot of interpreting, and we do occupy the same physical reality. But what differs is interpretation of this reality. Say there's one person that hits another person, like, the physical reality is the same for everybody. Like, there are two bodies, and one made the movement in space and hit the other, like, right? But why it happened, can be radically different, the interpretation. And so we are making meanings, and our meanings depend on the context that we live in as society, right? Again, people influence each other. And they are not absolute, not by definition unchanging. So in this sense, we are meaning makers, and imperfect, because we have all those limitations placed on us because of the way our brains work, because of the way our sensations work. So it's not a like a bad thing, something to be ashamed of, but it's something just to recognize that it makes us more careful, makes us more sort of receptive to other points of view, because when we think, well, I created, the, you know, this is my meaning that I can trace where it comes from and it's dear to me. Like I don't want to say that it's not true, it's not important, but I can also understand where it comes from, and I can understand why somebody else can think differently, and the fact that somebody else is biased, yeah, it's true, but I'm also biased, and so we still can have a conversation with each other, acknowledging each other's vulnerability.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important. I you know, the vulnerability piece is really refreshing to see, you know, it throughout your book. And I also, when I talk to my students, I one of the approaches that I have is to really remember that we are human and to just humanize situation. Like you remember that, you know, celebrities, for example, they are human. And so even though you can have someone like Kim Kardashian as a media object, she's still a person. And then as an audience, we don't really have access to the person, right? We have access just to the media personality. I think it is important, because otherwise we can create meanings that are, that end up being toxic. And I think that's why we have a lot of toxicity, I think, in online discussions. You know, when you think about like YouTube comments, you know, like just the anonymity, and these are, we are creating meanings, and we are perhaps drawing out stereotypes and things like that. So there are those, when you kind of go into chapter three, where you talk about paradoxes of power. So, because there is power in the audience and in those of us that are consuming the content. But, you know, when we think about, and you mentioned this, you know, just right off the bat in chapter three, like in a capitalist society, meaning making does become a profitable business. And we can't ignore that, right? Because capitalism does thrive on that. So when we think about creating popular culture, and we think about mass, you know, when we think about media conglomerates like Disney, they're incredibly powerful. And if they create texts that perpetuate stereotypes, then all of a sudden that is perpetuating and creating meaning that can become very dangerous, right, to society. So when you think about, you know, powerful people, how do you think? So describe more and talk a little bit more about these paradoxes of power that you discuss in chapter three.
Thank you for this question, because I do hope that this would be another important take away from this book for my readers, is my ideas about power. And I actually introduce a theory that I call theory of micro and macro power. And by introducing this theory, my goal was to show that we can at the same time want to keep people accountable. We can and should say, well, abuses of power happen, and there are some bad actors who hurt others, and something needs to be done. But at the same time, we want to put it in a bigger context and understand why, sort of look at some problematic actions that happen in the world from the perspective of how we can fix that without just relying on blame, without just saying, well, there, you know, people who abuse their power, they can fix that. Because so the theory of micro and macro power, why I called it this way, because I talk about society as kind of, you can look at two very different planes of reality in society. And so if you look at a relationship between specific individuals, say just take a pair of individuals, any pair of individuals that have some interaction, there is always going to be some kind of power relationship between them. If you put this in a context of time, if you look at this pair of individuals in the context of time, then a balanced relationship would be a relationship where each person has a turn when they have more power than the other person, when they get to decide. Like, think of a couple in marriage, right? So two different people, right? They won't agree on everything. But if just one person all the time dictates to the other person what they're supposed to do, like, this is wrong, right? Or a parent and a child can be the same thing. So yes, a parent is supposed to tell child a lot of times like what they're supposed to do. But if a parent never listens to the child and never does like what the child does, what the child wants, and the parents kind of says like, okay, whatever, like I will do it now for you because you really want it, right? Then, you know, I think this is also problematic relationship. So this is still very simple because we're looking at just relationship between two individuals, but and I call it micro power. What's going on there, right? It's like this micro relationship. But no pair of individuals exists in a vacuum. And once you start looking at other relationship, other individuals around it, because each one of us is connected to so many people, and each of the people that we are connected with is connected to so many other people. So then if we look at power relationships between those other people and the couple that we started with, the pair of individuals, you know, it's become so much more complicated because sometimes, say, a parent tells a child what to do and forces the child to do something because the parent feels that they have to do that because in society, like, this is a norm, right? Or in their community, this is a norm, right? And the more we zoom out of the specific pair, the more complicated things become, to the point that it just becomes like mind-boggling. And then it's sort of like a mind experiment that you imagine a whole society. Our brain cannot really do that. But if we could imagine the whole society with all the relationships between all the individuals, it would be incredibly difficult to say like who has power over whom. So even say the most powerful people who, you know, we feel like they influence tons of people, right? They also grew up in a certain context. Like the values that they have, they learned from people around them. So people around them influenced them, right? And the things that they're doing, right, it's based on perceptions on certain principles that they themselves didn't necessarily come up with, right? Again, it's very difficult to I spend so much time trying to formulate this. I bet I explained it better in the book than I did right now. And I'm honestly just, you know, continuing the theme of vulnerability. I am concerned and I'm scared about how people might interpret this because I feel like people will be angry at me and say like I'm excusing some bad actions, right? And I'm just ignoring that some people have access to so many other people that they can influence, right? And actually, like I know that you want to ask me at some point about my future projects. That's one of my future projects that I really feel like I dedicated just one chapter in this book to the idea of power. Like I want to write more about that and explain it better. But yeah, my concern is that people will say like I'm just saying that kind of like you brought Disney as an example. I will say Well, Disney is they don't have power and then it doesn't matter like what they do. It's most important thing is like what people who watch Disney do. And that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say that everybody is playing this game, right? In different ways. And it's also, again, this idea that runs through the book that we need to be more self-aware and take more responsibility for what we do and not just expect that somebody else will come and fix stuff because it's somebody else's fault.
Right. Yeah, no, I think, you know, related to this in a perspective in terms of looking at, for example, continue picking on Disney is when I tell my students well, what would happen if all of a sudden, you know, one day people just boycotted Disneyland and decided not to go to the theme parks or decided not to go, you know, and watch a movie or something like that? Would Disney as a corporation all of a sudden listen? They would, right? So it's like this idea that people don't have power. We do. That power may have to be in mass, right? Versus like the power that Disney itself as a corporation has. So I cannot appreciate the micro macro that you bring in. I think I discuss it a little bit differently in my classroom, but I think that it is important to look at this. It's not always just a top down, because Disney would absolutely listen if there's, you know, if there's a backlash, because that means that we have to be able to hold corporations accountable, you know, for, especially when they do have that much power. Right. So I think that there is, those elements in terms of looking at the complexity and the complex relationship we have with media and media companies and media texts. And I think, you know, you move in and start talking about, for example, that you state that blame is not the answer. So you mentioned that in chapter 4. So why is blame not the answer?
Well, so I know that some people will not agree with me on that, right? And I think, again, it's a matter of trying to phrase it very carefully. So I don't think that we should, if something is wrong, like if we feel that something is wrong, if we're not happy about something, say how we are treated or some group of people is treated, you know, we should say that. We should talk about that honestly and openly. But there's a difference between blame that is sort of like this easy act of finding the guilty party and kind of isolating them, and versus sort of trying to understand the complexity of it and the complexity that I try to explain in the chapter about power, for example, right? So we absolutely should share what we are unhappy about, but learn to do it in a way that, yeah, that incorporates this more nuanced outlook.
Okay. And when we think about, so you talk about the, you know, this concept of blame, and then you kind of go into talking about awareness, right? So you wrap up the book talking about ACE IT, and the concept or the rationale is behind ACE, is awareness to collaboration through empathy. So then this is really focusing on kind of wrapping everything together with this notion of empathy, which is something that I think many of us strive for. And you even mentioned that it's difficult to get to that point, and we often fail at being empathetic, and perhaps there's some disconnect in terms of how we deal with empathy and how we can be empathetic while still owning perhaps some negative emotions that are related to whatever, right? Whatever the cause is, or whatever we're trying to be empathetic towards. So can you expand and talk more about the ACE concept and what this all really means in relationship not only to the book, but really, again, to that greater conversation about media?
Yeah, so that's the last chapter that I call ACE IT. It's like a play on words, because I talk about this model, the practical model, ACE, A-C-E, which, as you said, means from awareness to collaboration through empathy, right? So again, the awareness piece is essential, because we do want to see the imperfections of society. We do want to acknowledge that bad things happen and some people suffer and there are inequalities, right? But we do not want that awareness to prevent, to create so much, you know, anger and blame that creates divisiveness, right? We don't want that, because then we cannot come together as society and think of more constructive solutions together. So an empathy piece is essential there. And I think that empathy is a concept that is often misunderstood, because people think of empathy as just sort of kindness, right? So people think, well, why would I be empathetic to a person that, like, whose actions I think are horrible, right? Because I don't want to like them. I don't want to, I don't want to be kind to them. Or I don't want to excuse them. That's nothing, because people think being empathetic meaning excusing somebody. Well, so no, that's not it. Being empathetic, you need to understand that empathy has a emotional and cognitive aspects. And I think it might be a revelation for people to know that psychopaths, for example, have empathy, you know. Because the empathy is not, seeing a kitty and seeing how cute. Empathy is part of it, like this, the cognitive part, is understanding another person's actions from their perspective. It's a lot about perspective taking. So in this sense, empathy really is not about excusing somebody's actions. You can still be very angry and upset about somebody's actions, but you can make this effort to understand them in a broader context. And I know there are common explanations when we don't like somebody's actions as, like, they're mean or they're stupid. It's just two big common explanations, right? But I really don't like them, because I think they hide so much complexity, and nobody's just mean or just stupid. These words are very intransparent. There are always some things behind people's actions that, when we dislike those actions, we can find those things out. And actually, when we find those things out, that makes us better at fixing things that we think are wrong. And in some cases, it can allow us to not in all cases, I'm saying not in all cases, but in some cases, we can actually find ways to interact with that other person that whose actions we dislike, and find some common ground and actually do some things together. I know this book starts like a media studies, kind of book, right? But it really expands to those broad topics. And by the end, you see that I'm actually writing a lot about, referring a lot about the current situation in the United States with growing polarization. And I just hope that having this more nuanced understanding of media will lead to more nuanced understanding of ourselves, and then as a result to hopefully can contribute to diminishing this divisiveness.
Yeah, I agree. I think the concept, yeah, of empathy is certainly important. I think there's definitely of those who would argue that, psychopaths would lack empathy in terms of truly wanting to empathize with another human being, but I think that there's something related to perspectives, and you can acknowledge someone else's perspective, but it doesn't mean that you are going to empathize with it, right? So I think that's one of the the issues of that make our awareness or our media literacy that much more complex, because I think it depends also on the context, and you kind of go in and talk about you kind of give a guide in terms of talking about media literacy from Renee Hobbs, and like the media literacy smartphone exercise, and you've changed it and kind of bring in really to kind of contextualize and I think bring awareness, right? So who created this, what techniques are used to attract and hold attention, what values, assumptions, lifestyles, and points of views are embedded, how many different people interpret or use this differently, what is hidden or omitted. So I think doing that analytical breakdown can be very powerful. I think this is something that, can easily be adapted into a classroom exercise. And was that your intent for this to be something that can be practical for anyone to use?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I do hope, I know that most of the book is theoretical, but I added this last chapter to tie it all together and to show that there's some practical implications to all of that. And yes, I talk about so awareness, and I talk about empathy and different ways to actually practice that. And I offer specific tools to do that, which is just an example. There are other things one can do, but these are examples. And yeah, so I definitely hope that people will use that. But it's also another thing that I want to work on, another book that I want to write, where the practical part will be more important than theoretical part, and people can get more tips on things that they can do.
Great. Yeah, I think your book is excellent. I really enjoyed reading. It was refreshing to read something that was, you know, that kind of has that personal perspective, but still valuable academically. And I think that, you know, that the practical component really wraps things up very nicely. So I definitely appreciate
that.
Thank you. So we've taken up a lot of your time, but as we wrap up, is there anything that you're currently working on? Like, what's next for you from this book?
Yeah, I have a few projects on different stages of different stages. I am working on a book about polarization that will be more practical. And essentially, I want to take the ACE model and I want to unpack it and turn it into specific exercises. I call it ACE Fitness Club.
Oh,
people can actually use in their everyday lives, because I feel like there are a lot of books about polarization, but often they have sort of some general solutions that people might not know how to apply that to their everyday life. So that's one thing. And I didn't start it yet, but I want to work on a book about power where I explain that in much more detail than I did in that one chapter. So yeah, there's other stuff, but yet fleshed out.
No, that's great. I keep me posted on that, and then I'll have you back on, and you can talk about the ACE Fitness Club, which is great. So thank you again for joining us, Elisaveta, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you. Bye.